The following program has been brought to you by Rolling Press, a family-run, eco-friendly printing company. For more information, visit rollingpress.com.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irwey, and we're gathered round here. Quite a party at Roberta's Pizza, as usual. And I have author Suzanne Cope joining us. How are you?
I'm great. So psyched to be here.
So, Suzanne, you're a food writer. You've written for Edible Everything, Edible Boston, Edible Cape Cod, and you're a writing professor at Manhattan College. And this is your first book. It's called Small Batch, Pickles, Cheese, Chocolate, Spirits, and the Return of Artisanal Foods. And you interviewed folks from around the country to do this book in pickles, cheese, chocolate, and artisanal foods. But a few of the folks that you did not interview, we brought on air as well. So just wanted to briefly introduce. Who are you, young lady?
I am Lena McCarthy. I own Anarchy in a Jar. We make mustard and jam.
Excellent.
Hi, I'm Brian Ballin, half of A&B American Style, and we make all-natural pepper sauces from fresh chili peppers.
From Brooklyn Grange Farm, right?
That's right.
Or something.
Absolutely.
It's so delicious. Okay, and?
My name is Marissa Wu, and I'm the owner of Salty Road. We make saltwater taffy, only makers in New York City.
You're the what?
The only saltwater taffy makers in New York City.
Well, we have so much saltwater. I don't get it. I'm just kidding. Yeah. I'm about to bite into one of Marissa's taffies. They're actually really, really good. And one of the things, I mean, you explore in this book, Suzanne, is that these craft foods are just really good, and there's something that you can't get everywhere. Something, you know, like Lena, we have jam. We've seen jam, Smuckers, and we've seen Tabasco sauce, sure. Laffy Taffy. What do you think makes this food movement so unique, Suzanne?
Well, what I thought was so interesting is that I thought it'd be so easy. Oh, I'm going to interview all these people, and obviously everyone knows that there's a ton of new cheese people and a lot of new spirits distillers. But then I realized that so many of these people were they were regional, and it was easier for me living in Brooklyn, and I was living in Boston for part of the research to find the people who were close by. But then when I wanted to do some research across the country, I found that it was a lot harder to find these people. You can't just Google, Google saltwater taffy or Google cheese and San Francisco and find out whether these people were really big in their neighborhoods and really popular. So I had to go and do some on the ground research. So sad. It was actually a ton of fun.
Sounds delicious.
And then I asked a lot of my friends. Of course, I have a lot of friends who are into the same things. And so they gave me their recommendations of the pickle makers that I should talk to in, you know, Northern California. And it was a really great trip. And I met people and found products that I wouldn't have found just via the internet alone.
Mm-hmm. And is that why you decided to write this book? Because they share a common theme, even though they're different regions, different specialties, different kinds of cheeses. But you found a common
ground. I found what was so great is I had these assumptions that I think so many other consumers thought about as well, where you just think, oh, here are these people just sitting at their, in front of their sink or their stove, and they're just making things in their kitchen. It's like, no, of course not. These are really smart business people who were really passionate about a product and passionate about where it all came from, but then also smart about it. And they wanted to figure out a way to make a business and maybe be their own boss and get it to the consumers who would really appreciate it. And also, for the most part, the sourcing was a lot more environmentally sustainable as well. So, just like using a local farm, which is so great, I found that by and large, this new artisanal movement, it wasn't just, wherever we could get the hot peppers, it was actually thinking about where they were coming from.
Absolutely. Something about what you just said made me look at the saltwater taffy box from Marissa Salty Road's box. And it says, I've come a long way from stretching taffy by hand in a tiny Brooklyn apartment. It was love at first pull.
So my assumptions were not that far off.
But I thought you were making an interesting face, Marissa, when Suzanne was saying something about smart business people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think I'm still learning a lot. Mm-hmm. I've learned a ton, but I still, like, every day I'm like, oh, my God, I have so much more.
Figuring it out as you go along.
Yeah. Well, just because you're doing every single aspect of it. And then also learning to stop doing that.
And you're a one-woman business, basically. Yeah. Is that same for, well, you have a partner, Brian, in the A to the B.
Correct.
American style. But was this a passion project, or were you like a totally conniving business person? I'm just kidding.
So, I mean, we, you know, Ariel and I grew up together really loving spicy foods. And actually in 2010, I was working in, you know, big bank, actually, in a corporate job, sort of seeing that a lot of people were getting disconnected from mm-hmm. all the food. So I actually left my job. I got a 4 days later, I sort of had left the suit behind. I got a job at Budokan as a line cook. I worked there for over a year specifically to learn all about great food. And then we, you know, we worked a long time to develop the recipes that became A&B American style.
Absolutely. Wonderful. Congrats. And I know you were just talking a little bit off air about how you just started to do it seriously, and because you left your other, you left your day job to do this, so you're in it for the long run.
That is, let's hope. Yeah, we're trying to be as long as possible.
Congrats.
Thank you very much.
And Lainey, you're a little farther along, I guess. You've been running Anarchy in a Jar for 6 years, or
mm-hmm.
how long?
5 years. Yep, 5 years this last summer. So, and it's, you know, it's a steady growth. When I started the company, I was interested in running a business, but I also saw at the time that I started my company, there was kind of a mini little explosion of small companies. So Brooklyn Brine and Pickles and Mama O's Kimchi and P&H Soda, Morris Kitchen Syrups, like all these, we all started the same summer, basically. And partly the reason we all started, none of us knew each other, but there was a sudden more of a demand, especially around New York, for food with a story, mm-hmm. not just local, but interesting things that people were making. And so I think all of these companies kind of filled that demand. So we met that demand, and then that really helped us because that demand was kind of across the board. So companies like Whole Foods, they also wanted to be more interesting. They didn't want to look the same as Walmart or any other company. And so the aid of grocery stores, the birth of things like Smorgasburg, which also came about from a demand that people wanted. And so all those things kind of happened and right. helped us all start right. our companies and keep our companies going. So,
because I mean, imagine, you know, I recall when I was growing up, there was always like those small tinkers at the farmer's market selling their goat butters and products and small batch jams too. But I really think that there's something that occurred with the demand and the awareness that you write about, Suzanne, that grew out of, I guess, the slow food movement. Where does that all start, actually?
I think that there are a number of factors that this movement is different than what we saw before. Part of it is that the people who are interested in making their own cheeses and jams and selling them, they kind of wanted to do it outside of the economy that we all participate in. You know, they weren't really interested in saying, oh, let's get it into the grocery store for the most part. They were more interested in just living on their farm, and maybe this is just an extra source of income. And then we have this new group of people like you guys, and your stories are so, they're classic. I mean, they're the exact stories that I was hearing from all these artisans around the country. You know, this idea of finding this cooperative, I call it, actually I didn't name it, but Michaela Hayes of Crock and Jar Pickles, she called it co-opetition, where all these people started at the same time, mm-hmm. but they weren't in direct competition with each other. They actually wanted to help each other out. So maybe being the only taffy person, and that's your problem, is that you don't have this cooperative group helping you.
Do you see co-opetition in your business? All of you? Anyone?
Yeah, and I actually think that should be your next book, Suzanne. No, I'm serious about this because this is something that I gripe about to journalists all the time. And I'm always like, no one has written about this. As far as I'm aware, no one has ever really talked about the connections between companies. And I feel like I only exist because I have, like, I call them my comrades, which, of course, you guys are all my comrades as well. But, you know, and, like, Marissa and I, we've, like, been next to each other at
Smorgasburg.
Yeah, at Smorgasburg and markets, and, like, we help each other, you know? We help each other. We watch each other's booths. Especially the dudes like Seamus and Kadeem, who does Mamo's, like, we all needed each other. We share information on, like, you know, it started out as like, oh my God, who has a good accountant? And now it's like, you know, who has a good distribution
Jars,
network? Oh, you know what? Someone's not paying
us.
Let's like get on that. And we actually work as like a team to not only keep our network alive, but to help each other.
Yeah.
So, and I mean, there is competition to a degree, but I feel like actually we're all aware of the fact that like, we need each other to survive.
That's what I thought was so cool. I was anticipating people saying, oh, there better not be another pickler because they're going to take my business. And Seamus said, no. He goes, nobody wants to be the only restaurant on the block. No. You want there to be other people because just like you were saying, this demand grew organically. And the more people who are interested in it, the more they, A, appreciate how much work goes into these products, mm-hmm. and B, they start to see that there is a real value in buying things that were locally sourced, sustainably sourced, or you know, if it's not local, just thinking about preserving traditions and a handmade ethos and way of producing things, which I think is really important.
Yeah, I actually interned with Little Bit Sweets, which I guess would be somewhat of a competitor or something like
Absolutely.
That. And then I also interned with The Meat Hook, and I worked at the Brooklyn Kitchen. And I feel like all those relationships have helped me like immensely in growing the company and getting advice and having different perspectives, but people that are still in sort of...
So it's a community.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah. And it sounds like you encountered this, Suzanne, throughout your travels.
The other place that that actually used the word cooperatician, although mm-hmm. I like coopetition better, was out in Portland, Oregon, of course, where they also mentioned that same kind of community and ethos, specifically with the distillers, which I thought was really great.
Distilleries are a huge part of this craft artisanal movement because, you know, that's just a product that wasn't really being made in an artisanal way, you know, since Prohibition. So... That is a great example that you highlighted in this book. What do you think are some like the most quintessential hallmarks of an artisanal food?
You know, this actually, this book grew in part out of the fact that I'm sure we all experienced people calling things artisanal, including Frito-Lays.
It's a wishy-washy word,
and I
right?
was so mad about that. And I just thought, wait a second, this... You know, you can't have an artisanal bun at Burger King or whatever.
Yeah, Doritos.
So I was so mad, and I thought, I'm in a position where I am going to define this term, and I'm going to define it by talking to a bunch of people who consider themselves artisanal, and maybe this is somewhat self-selecting. I also thought of them as being artisanal in one way or the other, and kind of, I don't want to say crowdsourced because it was a more academic approach, but, you know, figure out through the words of other people how they define this term. And so some of the commonalities I found are exactly what you're hearing from you guys. The fact that people wanted to do something with their hands, wanted to be more involved with the food system, wanted to be more thoughtful about the raw materials and also, the finished goods. And this idea of community, people, for the most part, these artisans, they wanted to serve their immediate community first. They weren't, of course, I'm sure all of you guys would be happy if you had national distribution, but, you know, not saying national distribution is the first goal. Yeah, maybe not. I found actually a mix of people saying, I'm perfectly happy selling within a couple hundred miles. And so that idea of serving the immediate community and then maybe thinking about expansion, but being very thoughtful about expansion and still staying within these larger mission of being, community minded and more environmentally sustainable. That certainly, those are
it
all commonalities.
It sounds easier said than done, for sure. Let's talk a little bit about more your journeys and the challenges as we come back to this program after a quick little commercial interlude.
wind blowing back, I think this is freedom. But thank you for a reason to stay, stay. I could have gone home, regret is just how it is. Thank you for a generous side, side. It should go with these great lengths. Wow. Yeah, you were trying not to cry, telling him the reasons that you had to leave him. Thank you for a reason to stay, stay. I could have gone home with regrets, it's just how it is. Thank you for a generous side.
You are listening to Trial and Error by Snowmine.
Today's program was brought to you by Rolling Press. Rolling Press is a family-run digital and offset print house that brings together eco-friendly methods, ethical practices, and personalized service. Using environmentally responsible papers, non-toxic inks, and wind power, Rolling Press represents the harmony of traditional craftsmanship and mindful sustainability. Rolling Press offers advice on reducing paper waste and energy consumption, helping you save money and minimize your carbon footprint. For more information, visit rollingpress.com.
Hey, my name is Betsy Andrews, executive editor of Severa Magazine, and I am hanging out at the coolest, most delicious place in the world, heritageradionetwork.org.
All right, we're back chatting more with Suzanne Cope, author of Small Batch Pickles, Cheese, Chocolate, Spirits, and the Return of Artisanal Foods, and a round table of artisanal food makers. So we were talking a little bit about defining the word artisanal, but Suzanne, you also write that many other colliding values go into the, you know, small batch artisanal, I think, is one thing. But as it happens, this new generation shares a lot of values which have to do with natural, slow, local. And let's talk a little bit about the natural side of things. I noticed all you guys don't use GMOs and you try to use local ingredients, no corn, no high fructose corn syrups. And each of these products could very well have those product, high fructose corn syrup.
Yeah. But the corn syrup that I use have GMOs.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So you were talking about labeling though. And
yeah, sorry. I mean, GMO, you can actually get certified now to be officially label your product GMO free.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great. It just takes time because you actually have to, in order to do it, you have to provide documentation of every single ingredient that's in your product and documentation of its source and that it's actually also GMO free.
Does it cost money too?
Yes.
And none of you label organic because, you know, as we know, there's a lot of hoops and, you know, things to jump through to get that certification. And this is just another step in the way. But, you know, it sounds like all three of your ingredients are as natural as it comes and local. So, yeah, congrats for that.
You know, I found this reminded me of one of the picklers I spoke with, you know, I think faced some of these other issues too, where he
wanted to expand beyond the local farmers market, and he wasn't certified organic, even though he knew that the farm where he got stuff from was organic. But because of the additional cost and all this paperwork that you have to go through, he had to make that decision. Do I sever ties with this one close farmer who he'd been working with since the beginning, or do I source from someone else just so I can have organic on my label? And it's really hard because it is expensive, and it's manpower that you guys were just saying over the break that it's hard to find. So, you know, it really puts, I think, producers in a difficult position sometimes.
And many other things as you scale up become a little bit more difficult. I recall Lena used to pick your fruit by hand, and obviously that's not going to last if you're going to grow as time goes on. What are some other challenges of growing?
But actually, I think that's also a cool thing, too, though, about growth is, like, and probably someone like Seamus mentioned this as well, but, and you experienced this, I'm sure, too, with your hot sauce, which is that the cool thing about growing is you maybe don't have the same relationship. So, I do not pick my fruit myself anymore from my friends' farms upstate, but I do... I am able to support networks like Green Market, like Grow NYC has a wonderful wholesale program and a few different, and supporting things like that, there's a few different cooperative
there's
buying
more
options.
Outlets,
yeah,
sounds like,
yeah.
For you to get that product
yeah.
that you need.
Yeah.
And Brian, what about you? How long are you going to be able to get all the peppers you need as you scale up from a rooftop farm in Brooklyn?
Yeah, it's been tough. I mean, so we've been working with them sort of every year. We do a seasonal batch, and it really, that's all it can be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, New York obviously gets cold in the winter, so you can't grow all the time.
Limited edition
exactly.
batch, yeah.
So we do it annually. We love to support them in what they're doing. But otherwise, you know, we try to work as closely as we can directly with farms all across mm-hmm. the country, generally, you know, down south. You know, it's been interesting. I think, like you talked about, the growth... When we first started, everything was very expensive, and we didn't know if we'd be able to make it happen.
Oh.
And as we, even just like a little bit of growth, really has brought the cost down to make it to a place where it looks like this can be a lot more sustainable for a lot longer. So.
Oh, fantastic.
Is that exciting. Because yeah. of economies of scale? That's why.
Yeah, and they're you know, surprisingly small. You know, it was initially we bought it by the case. We sort of went into Whole Foods and said, can we just have 10 pounds of chilies? Mm-hmm. And then we kept going from there. And then now we go direct from the farm, and we, you know, hire a refrigerated truck to drive it up from Florida or North Carolina. And that's, you know.
And that's your...
Yeah, we didn't have to get too much farther to actually get that.
For your purchase only. And Marissa, you had a milestone breaking in a new space of your own to produce in.
Yeah, we used to do everything by hand, including pulling the taffy, cooking it, cooling it, cutting and wrapping it, and then we had a co-packer mm-hmm. for a while in Maine, and then we were able to buy machinery, confectionery machinery to pull it and to cut and wrap it. The cut and wrapper is actually the most important piece of equipment. We could, between me and another woman that works for me, we would be able to cut and wrap 4 pieces in a minute, and now we can cut and wrap 100.
Wow.
So,
in a minute, yeah.
Oh.
It's big, yeah. Our margins I was like, okay. Oh, thank God.
Is it like Willy Wonka when you walk into this? I just really want to see that machine and the taffy.
I have pictures of it.
Pulling.
It's awesome. It is. It's like I have a candy factory. It's pretty rad.
So fun. Well, congrats on that. Now scalability. That's very exciting. And where do you hope to go with this now that you can produce more, you have your own space? It's probably very expensive to get that investment.
Yeah, it was. I think it was really important for us to come back to be able to actually manufacture in Brooklyn, which I think is a really hard thing to do, especially when you have a co-packer, to be able to like make that decision and put that money in. But this is where I live, and also it enables us to be able to make different flavors. Like we have a pumpkin pie that's seasonal with our co-packer. We weren't able to create new flavors,
I see. So you had to hand off your recipes and sort of be like, take care of my babies. And
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And we had to, we weren't able to sort of control the manufacturing process as much, obviously, as we
right,
are now.
Right.
So stuff is fresher. It tastes better.
Brian, do you use a co-packer, or is this something you produce?
We do. Mm-hmm. We do use a co-packer, and he's been great.
So
it's still a very manual process. I think the interesting thing about a co-packer is you sort of imagine that they have all this machinery everywhere, mm-hmm. and it really turns out they just have a lot of people. So everything mm-hmm. really manages to keep that same kind of handmade touch that's the same as when A and B first started.
So it's like their staff or my staff.
Exactly.
And Lena, do you have your staff?
Yeah, we don't use co-packers. We do it all in Brooklyn at our little factory. So I have my own staff that do it.
Mm-hmm. And how do you imagine what do you imagine would be the next step from here if you were to expand?
At some point in the next year or so, we'll probably expand into a larger space just as we now distribute all over the country. So we'll probably, we're just growing more and more. And as we get more and more distribution, we have to make more and more jam. Mm-hmm. And we have our space is now like jam up to the ceiling. So, that's like the natural evolution of it. And that's what makes it difficult about making product in New York City is it's just incredibly expensive. So,
mm-hmm. Suzanne, when you're researching this book and you're just, as you were saying, word of mouth, finding out about all these different distilleries one after another, were you surprised about how large this movement was the more you looked into it?
I was amazed and I was amazed that every urban area, and I'm sure rural areas that I didn't make it to, had this strong community happening. And I was also amazed at what was being produced in a small space. I'm sure if I went into your jam factory, I would see have that same realization as when I went in and I chatted with Brooklyn and Brian, where I walked in and I thought, oh, this is a cute little factory. They're doing a couple jars here and there. And then he told me he was distributed in multiple countries. And I thought, oh my gosh, I can't believe that every single jar is hand-packed. Somebody on his team touches every single jar, every single pickle that goes into that jar, and it makes its way all around the world. And I think that's so amazing what one person and one really small team can do in a relatively small space. And I thought that was amazing. And I'm still astounded. If I walk into your jam factory, I'll be like, what, really? Mm-hmm. It's really, really cool.
So yeah, so from my side of it as a consumer, it looks like this movement is ever growing. There's more and more companies making different products, new products, very interesting ones too. Do you see this as something that is going to continue growing? Is that what you came across?
I think so. And I asked all the artisans who I spoke with where they thought their industries were going as well. And pretty much everyone said, yeah, I think we're going to continue to grow.
Like they're expanding, and at the same time, there's
more people are joining
at different stages are expanding.
They all thought, okay, there's going to be some shakedown. Especially it's easy to compare, say, the distillers to the craft beer industry from a decade or so earlier. And what happened with that industry was there was a bunch of people who entered the market, and then some of them made it and did really well. Some of them made it at a middle level and continue there, and some of them didn't make it. And so that's kind of the thinking, is that there will be a shakedown with all of these new people joining the market, but many of them will succeed because more and more people are interested in buying these products.
Have we witnessed a shakedown a little bit? Have we seen some fallen?
I think so. I mean, small business is mm-hmm. tough, man, and it's especially tough here. So yeah, people fall off.
I've seen some mergers too, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, we're scrappers.
Changes. All right, so we only have a couple minutes left, but Suzanne, thank you so much for joining us. And I just wanted to get a last sort of like bite from each of you about why you're doing what you're doing, even though it's so tough, as you just said, Marissa.
I think small business is just really rad. I think that it's a lot of work, but I mean, who wouldn't want to have their own candy factory for reals? Like, this is what I do all day.
I can't wait to see it.
Yeah.
you guys right on.
Yeah, I mean, for A&B American Style, we like to believe that we're doing something bigger. We're part of this really important movement that's helping people reconnect with their food. So right now we make our spicy pepper sauces from all fresh ingredients. We don't use any added sugar. It's very little salt. There's obviously no artificial preservatives. We hope we can grow and help support more organic farmers to make the transition and help our production.
Keep producing what
exactly.
They're doing.
Just sort of encourage the food system to be better positioned to kind of be more sustainable going forward. And that's our, that's our idea. And I hope that we can continue to push on that mission.
Awesome.
Ditto what he just said. And I think also we, I hope to continue having fun doing what I do as well. I think that's part of the pleasure of owning your own business is as though it's tough at times, but it's also really fun.
It beats your last day job.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like really, and the connections you build and the relationships and just, and even learning, like constantly having new hurdles that you have to overcome is interesting. Mm. It certainly keeps life interesting.
Totally. So. All right. Well, thanks for keeping the shelves interesting. And
thank you so much. I also want to say I've already invited everyone in this room I'm hosting a small batch pop-up at Jimmy's number 43 on November 5th from 6 to 8 p.m. So come on down and buy their products. I'm sure you could buy them many other places as well. But yeah, it'll be
really
fun.
And books for sale there,
and there'll be books for sale, of course.
Excellent. So check out the history of small batch some more. Thanks so much, Suzanne.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. Yeah,